Okay. Well, if everybody's here, we'll get started. Welcome to the fourth week of the class, both students and community people. Just a few administrative items, and then we'll get to our speaker. There's still a couple students who have missed lectures, and I need their paragraph summary emailed to me. So please get that done sooner rather than later, because I suspect you'll be even busier toward the end of the quarter. And as I mentioned last week, if you have any comments or thoughts about our speakers, you know, please send them to me and or the speaker, because it's good to know that, you know, you have some thoughts and about what's being said. I mentioned for people working on projects, we'd like to have a midterm meeting. And this shouldn't take more than 15 minutes per team. So there's lots of options as far as dates. And maybe the one good idea is to have it before or after class on the 12th or 19th, or on Friday on the 15th or 22nd. So if team leaders could sort of discuss amongst themselves when would be the best time, please email that to me and we'll set up a place to have it. There's nobody in this classroom immediately before or after class, so we do it here if it was on a Tuesday. And if it's on a Friday, we'll probably meet in Termin. Okay? And the purpose of the midterm meeting is just to see where you are, and if you look at the website, there's a fuller discussion about, you know, what we're going to ask. Okay. Okay. Website, a lot of material on there, including audio and slides from previous speakers, if they had slides. Next week, we're in for a treat. We're going to have our own very own Terry Adams speaking to us, as well as a couple Stanford product design students on need finding. So it should be really interesting. Of course, you don't want to miss that either. Any questions so far? Is everybody working hard on their project? You know that the due date is, I believe, the end of next week. Is that right? Yeah. So this week, we are very lucky to have Ted Selker, who is an associate professor at the MIT Media Laboratory, and he's out here this year to Stanford's benefit. I've known him for years and years, and over the years, he's worked at Atari, Xerox PARC. He's a fellow at IBM. He designed and developed the TouchPoint pointing device on IBM laptops, and of course he's most recently at the Media Lab. He's been involved with or taught at Stanford, the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and Brown University, and he's co-director of the Voting Technology Project, which he'll talk a little bit about, and co-director of the Counterintelligence Design Intelligence Special Interest Group on Product Design of the Future. So either you're very old or you've done an awful lot of work. Okay, so as we transfer the microphone, let's welcome Ted. Howdy.
So there's a couple ways to run this lecture. I'm a constructor. I'm always making things, and my hands are, in fact, always dirty from that. And I believe in building. In fact, when I'm interviewing students to be undergrads, I always, you know, I separate the ones that have done things as the ones that will do things. So I hope you guys all do things, make things, write programs, and so on. It's kind of what you have to do to understand things deeply. The thing that I want to talk about today is just, first I'll just give you a little bit of an overview of who I am and what I do at the Media Lab, what I've been doing for the last several years, and then I'll just talk a lot about disabilities, design for disabilities that I've done, and design in general. These are some images from things I've made. We'll talk about some of them. We won't talk about this helmet, which basically mediates communication from a bicyclist to the world and lets you keep your hands on the wheel and your eyes upon the road. Because actually wearable computers, when they come between you and the world, they are really taking you away from the world. And I think a lot of technology, one of the things to think about is how do we integrate it into the places that we're going to be. I'm not going to talk about my smart kitchen or cognitive prosthetics for other things or ways of reminding you to have decorum when you're doing email. I will mention though that my current work in context aware computing, which is all about trying to recognize and respect human intention in the world, is to make a considerate world, a world where things have decorum, and that we are learning about decorum. I have an autistic child, and this guy, he's a great guy, he's getting great grades at Gunn High School, and love him, but he doesn't know how to respond in a socially appropriate manner, nor do any of the systems that we have. And in fact, most of us don't do very well once we're behind the keyboard of an email system. And so, just to give you an example, this is a system called Empathy Buddy, which is an email system that makes faces at you, giving an idea of what the tone of the email you're sending is. I mean, my son makes mistakes on the order of every 5 minutes when he's in a social situation that cost him basically the whole thing. I mean, they basically get him thrown out of things. I once had the police meet me at an when we got off an airplane. Lots of things happen. But certainly, he isn't trying to be socially inappropriate. Nor are we when we're flaming and losing friendships by making emails that are much more aggressive than they should be. By using kind of what I call the bag of sentences, common sense approach. The open mind system has collected 1 million sentences about everything. And when it looks at your sentences, it kind of compares them to similar sentences and tries to figure out whether it's about angry, surprise, happy, and so on, and then makes these faces, and it improves people's ability to respond appropriately. Not to go into too much detail, but there's about 48 different projects I've done over the last 9 years at the Media Lab, all about trying to show that systems can recognize human intention in appropriate ways and make impactful changes to the scenario to help people succeed. We've made smart cars and smart beds and smart kitchens and smart, postal service delivery trucks and so on. Just to give you an example of how some of this stuff is being used in the disabilities world, I started off by, I guess I want to focus on this thing at the bottom first. This is a set of pedals. And I started, it takes a long time to make these things. These pedals basically are gas pedal, and I've been working on them for years. The hard thing wasn't making the pedals. The hard thing was establishing that they do what I wanted them to do. So if you're driving a car and you're pedaling as a gas pedal, instead of just holding down a pedal, you're on a treadmill, what might happen is that you might find the activity invigorating. Maybe you'd get exercise, maybe you'd improve your acuity, maybe it'd keep you from going to sleep, and that's my goal. And so over the years, I've done experiments, and my goal was to help the 3 million people that fall asleep spontaneously all the time. This people with sleep disorders have 5 times more accidents than people that don't have sleeping disorders. That is an accident on the average every 2 years. But what we found is that in the middle of the afternoon, just taking a normal group of people, I can literally have them pedal 69 miles and If they are using a gas pedal after 12 minutes, on average, they kind of droop off. And I'm talking about able-bodied people. Don't drip off very long. Just kind of close their eyes. Whereas with these pedals, they don't. So it'd be nice to get, you know, turn up the air conditioner to get some exercise. Those are the kind of simple things that can make a big impact. Talking to insurance companies, talking to car companies, who knows? It's impossible to change anything. I'm not going to say anything more about all these other things except, well, yeah, I'll see. So here are some of the things I've done over the years. I think I met David when I was working at the VA Rehab R&D Lab in 1980. I came and visited and started thinking about helping some people that are trying to make a voice-activated robot. No, there's not a very good one yet. The pointing device that's in IBM's notebook has been an awful lot of fun from the disabilities point of view. I was responsible for the special needs package for an operating system called OS2, which runs on this machine. I've made a smart bed and pedaling car, a lot of different things that have to do with disabilities. I love doing things for the disabilities community because if you do it, it gets all this luster and you get this free press if you're making products and they say something to these people. The fact is that you're not very good. It's not a very easy place to get money. A lot of the people that work in that community have kind of threadbare clothes. And it's because, you know, if you're disabled, you're usually compromised, right? That's why they call it disabled. So I often find myself doing a better job of helping them by making things that everyone's going to use but are going to be really good for the disabled. For example, this is a notebook computer that IBM made, and I didn't make it so that it could go around my neck like this so that I could wear it this way. Or so that people that had trouble sitting down could use it. But it's really nice for that way. What was interesting that I wanted to show you about this, the first thing I want to show you about this, is you see that red, those red marks on those keys? That's a patented idea. That idea allows one finger or one mouse stick to go into drag mode with this pointing device. And that was a really hard thing to get into product. It made about 15% performance improvement for everyone in the drag operation. That's how I got it in. But the disabilities issue was a big part of it also. It isn't on any of the new ones. Why isn't it on any of the new ones? It's not on the new ones because they all have integrated into them a gesture language. Let me say a few things about this pointing device. I thought it was a six-week project. I thought, okay, you know, I'd read this book by Card and Moran that showed that basically people were better at using a knee bar than a mouse for the first 15 minutes of use. So the joystick, why was it that the knee bar, which is the part of our brain that controls, you know, that is controlled by the motor activity, that's the precentral gyri of the central sulcus is the sensory part. It's got almost no representation for your knee. So why would a knee be good at controlling a mouse for the first 15 minutes while you're typing? Anybody have an idea? And then you get better. Then the mouse is better after that. Well, no good ideas? Yeah? Well, that's kind of a clue, and the thing is that it turns out a couple pages later in that book by Card and Moran, I discovered that it takes 1.75 seconds to go from the hand from the keyboard over the mouse and back to the keyboard. So if you're no good at any pointing device, you might as well be no good at one that doesn't take your hands off the keyboard. Okay, and that's why it was better, in my view. And at that point, I wanted to put a keyboard in. That was 83. I wanted to put a pointing device in the keyboard. And I tried the thumb area, and now you see a lot of them with that touchpad. And I tried other places. And I tried many, many places. But basically, by saving, I only get back about a second of that 1.75 seconds. I guess it takes people time to think about changing from keyboard to pointing. But we got that 1 second back, and then we learned a bunch of other things, which I'll talk about. And I thought that this was only going to be good for keyboard pointing, but it turns out it's good for lots of things. What I've found amazing is that the people with hooks for hands, they love it. I don't know why, because it's always in the same place. And in a moment, I'll explain some other things about it. The people that are blind like it because it's always in the same place. And so there's a lot of things that I've learned about it being a good thing for different kinds of people. This is it being used in space. The space people like it because it doesn't drift all around like a mouse does when they until recently, I'm not sure if it's still true, that's the only kind of pointing device they used in space. They might have started using some other companies. So I talked about it takes time to go over there, and the other thing I found out is that for 100 years, people had been designing pointing devices. Rate control devices are ones where you press down like a gas pedal in a car, and then you go forward and you let off and you're there. So they felt great. And then they'd do a human factor study, and they'd find out that it was really too hard to compete with a position control device. And what it was is overshoot. People would go there, and it'd feel very difficult to get right to the thing you were trying to get to. And I found the same problem. And the first paper I found written about this was from the 1890s when they were trying to make controls for radios. But what I found out was that when I made a pointing device that was so hard to press that it hurt my finger, I went 25% faster at making selections. So we'd made a suite of experiments that allowed us to test how fast you could go from point to point on a screen as the way of designing the transfer function. Instead of making one that felt good and made me think that I'd made a nice one, I did ones that felt like, well, whatever they felt like, and they performed better. So that 25% performance improvement, I don't know what it was. And so I thought, well, maybe it's because when I press really hard, I have more dynamic range. So there was no literature, so I did an experiment where I made these circles, and I made the circle as small as I could and tried to hold the cursor in that circle. What I found out was that the finger only has about 4 or 5 bits of control, of force control, that it can accurately repeat. At which point, that was kind of, that kind of surprised me. It made me think, well, why is it that when the dynamic range rolls off at about 8 ounces, at 10 pounds, I'm getting a better joystick? Well, what it was is that it was too painful to make it go fast for me to go to fast. And what was happening is I was going slow enough that my eyes could track it and getting 25% better performance because I didn't have to go to the point, look around for the cursor, and bring it back. Why did it take 100 years for somebody to figure that out? In fact, it took another several years for Stu Card to agree that that was true. He'd written a paper in 1990 saying that linear transfer functions are always better than nonlinear. And I wrote a paper in 1990 at the same conference that showed a nonlinear transfer function that was a lot better, 25% better, and it was better in many different ways. One of the things that I discovered by having the learning that your fingers only has a little bit of control is I thought, well, what about for slow speeds? For slow speeds, can I stop really accurately? Not if my finger's always shaking and I can only get 4 or 5 bits of control. So for slow speeds, I got a 15% speed of selection improvement by just making a consistent speed rather than a controllable speed for pixel selection. That's in the product. There's a whole lot of it. There's 10 or 15 other algorithms in there. Most of the ideas that we got in making this thing, we got by having an idea from knowing some cognitive science and then going and experimenting and finding out we're wrong. So how is it that the human factors people have always thought, well, I'll make a really good thing and then I'll test it. I'll have my testers test it. When actually the right way to do better at improving performance is for the designer to be testing it. That's what I'm going to say over and over again if we have time. And that clock is so distracting. I have to have a clock in front of me or I won't. Okay, there. It's just the saying that nothing changes. And so one of the things that was most interesting to me as I was developing this thing is one day I got in the back of a van. It was Ed Fredkin's van, a guy that invented swapping. And there was this guy there named John McCarthy. How many people know who John McCarthy is? Oh, my God. John McCarthy is a professor here who's emeritus now. And he invented artificial intelligence. He also invented Lisp. Anybody know heard of the Lisp programming language? Okay, he's a fascinating guy. Incredible. One of the brightest guys of our time. Anyway, he gets in the back of his van, and he's in his mid-60s, and he's had palsy since he was 40. So we're in the back of this van, we're driving around, and he wanted to see my new invention. and his hands are going like this. And he sat down, and he did a very competent job of playing solitaire on the screen. So I realized, you know, the shakiness, get rid of nerve, is really good. You see, because I know to get rid of shakiness, I can get him, his palsy, not to matter so much. And also, because it knows how to stop quickly, it allowed him to make selections easily. And it's got a bunch of other tricks in it, too. I'll give you another example. I don't know. I didn't mean to give this to be a track point story. So I had this idea that when you're going in a direction with the cursor, you should keep going that direction. And guess what? There's a patent on that from the 40s. But when we tried doing experiments with that, it was terrible. There was nothing we could do that didn't make things worse. Because actually, you know, going in a direction is fine. It's when you want to make changes that's the problem. And so the opposite was what we wanted. We wanted kind of negative ABS brakes. So when you start, it starts up fast, and when you stop, it stops fast. So what we wanted to do is take the second, you know, the third derivative, basically. When we see you trying to change your direction, we do it extra fast. And that was another thing that helped him. Because when he's trying, when he shows indication of slowing down, it slows down quicker. And then he gets to that region where it doesn't even change its speed. No matter how he shakes his finger, it just goes there very, very quickly and makes it stop on a dime. So anyway, those are kind of some stories about that. And what I love about the pointing device, I'm not going to talk about this anymore, is that it is again, that these people with various disabilities love it better. Now, you guys might not, you know, you've tried it on the Toshiba, you've tried it on the Dell. Those aren't track points. Those don't have all those algorithms in them. No wonder they don't work. These algorithms took a long time to develop. The IBM, unfortunately, and some HPs are the only things that are made with it anymore. It's been, you know, a differentiator enough that IBM wasn't making any money on their notebooks. And as soon as they put this in, without changing any other features, they sold $500 million worth of them the first year, $1 billion the second, and $2 billion the next year, and $4 billion the year after that. So that's how I got to be an IBM fellow. There's a lot of different things on this picture of things that we learned about making it better. I'll just give you an example, a couple of examples that are in it right now that help people with disabilities. We had this idea that maybe why not have two hands instead of one? And so I tried, you know, two joysticks. And what would you do if you had two? I could have brought one in, but with two instead of one. Why would you want two pointing devices? Anybody got somebody other than him? Yeah? Oh, that's kind of the Etch-a-Sketch model. That's kind of interesting. Okay, so that would be one thing to do with it. Anybody else have an idea? Yeah, that again is a little. I don't know whether those would be good ideas, but they're interesting. Yes, one more. That's a very interesting idea because if you can move the pointer in the background, that's really what we do. We're always putting a book in front of our other hand to write on. Okay, this idea of setting things up with our non-dominant hand and doing it with our dominant hand is a very typical activity that people do. And it's interesting, again, John McCarthy said something interesting about it, but I don't want to get into that. Yes? Coarse and fine movement's an idea, that you could have a coarse knob and a fine knob. We tried lots of things, and what we found was if you use the tractor metaphor, you know, like driving a bulldozer, we could outperform a 3D control device like the Spaceball. For one doing foreground and one doing background, that had some value too. We also made something for people with eyesight problems, where when you use one of them is the magnifying glass, and one of them is working inside of it. And we also and what we found out, by the way, is two things. First, lots of things, but when these things were symmetrical, you got confused about which one was your left one and which one was your right one. When they were asymmetrical, then you were able to tell better which one was your left and which was your right. Finally, we realized that if we just had a button that changed between the left and the right, we could use the same pointing device. And that's what's on the product today. This blue button in the center is is when you push on it for the way it comes from the factory, it's scroll. And when you change it, if you push on it, then it is a magnifying glass when you push down on that middle button. But scrolling's nice too. So one of them's scrolling and one of them's selection. Another thing that's in this is press to select. If you press on this thing to get rid of that stupid little slide bar that I talked about, this one you press down and make a selection. That way you only have to use one finger or one mouth bar or one claw and a hand or whatever it is. And I think there's a lot of interesting work that can be done with this thing. I made at one point I made a pointing device that was a little teeny one that had a Velcro. You could Velcro it onto your wheelchair, and you could put a top on it that was bigger, so that you could grab it with your hand, and then you could put it on a table. And so it had a whole bunch of different configurations. We called it our Russian tea mouse. But the idea of having something that's better than just a toggle for controlling a wheelchair might be a fun thing to do with this thing. There's a lot more that could be done. Here's me on Good Morning America. I'm in a bed, and I worked with Boston Home a little bit on this. I kind of got away from it. They have 160 people with MS that can't do much, and they wanted me to use this. What we did is I have this camera up here with structured light looking at my face, and when I go to sleep, it turns off everything. When I wake up, it turns off the alarm clock and puts on the ceiling a big, beautiful field. And if I look at the TV, it turns on. And if I don't like the show that's playing, I blink nervously. And if I like it, I stare at it. And if I look at I can look at my email. I can look at a book. If I wink, it opens it up. So I'm using eye gestures to make selections. And we were able to do an awful lot just by having this thing, not where you're looking, because when you're looking, is your eye's a guard dog. It's busy deciding on lots of things, but it's got social gestures. I mean, if I start staring at you, it starts feeling uncomfortable. We don't just stare with our eyes. We stare when we're intimidating. A dog will, if you stare at a dog, it'll start barking. So we did a lot of work trying to think about how to make a gesture language of how to run your life from being in bed. And one of the fun projects was a jukebox that would decide, based on your feedback, what songs or what movies you wanted to watch. So it would record a profile of you based on this feedback of when you blink nervously, then changing. A lot of value possibility in having some intelligence to interpret things. So I got a chance to put intelligence into a website. I was part of anybody get to see The Forgetting? It was a PBS special on Alzheimer's a couple of years ago. Nobody saw it. Anyway, it's a really good show. And if I was online, we'd be playing with this thing. Go to PBS.org, The Forgetting, and then go to the Living Center. And in the Living Center, I made an interactive for people, caregivers and Alzheimer's patients, to work together. And I started off by thinking, oh, we're going to start off by giving everybody email and let them put their pictures of their life in there. These are the wrong idea. By working with experts, I realized those are all going to remind them of the things they can't remember anymore. And so what I did is I made a whole bunch of applications that all brought people into the moment. Because if you have Alzheimer's, basically you're often very critically sophisticated still. You've got all the ways of, when somebody puts on Tchaikovsky and somebody misses a note, you go, ooh. But you are productively challenged. You can't make even utterances often. You can't remember things. Your memory are hard to get your hands on. So what we did is we did things like we gave you a selection of pictures that would be a puzzle. And this one's a dog and a cat sitting together. And if you do nothing, these pieces fall down. In fact, one of my students at MIT was the kid that wrote Tetris when he was 16 and got a TV for it because they licensed it to Nintendo for something like $100 million, the Russian government. But anyway, so he made this. And these are falling down. And they're filling up this picture frame with this picture. But I've made it so you can see the picture anyway. And if you start fiddling with the cursor keys or the mouse, you end up being able to go faster. But when you're going faster, filling up this puzzle, people with Alzheimer's somehow like puzzles. I don't know. It gets harder. If you show competence, it starts putting pieces in the wrong place, and you have to put them in the right place. And if you get even better, it turns them and rotate. Now, one of the nice things about that is, first of all, you can see as you're having trouble, you succeed anyway. When you're having success, it makes it more challenging. If your 12-year-old kid comes and everybody wants to, you know, not have him bored, it gets extremely difficult. And so this adaptive system works that way. One of the things that these guys have is sundowning. If they go into a dark place or have dark lighting or imagery, they get depressed. And they love to arrange things. They're always wanting to pack their bags. They think they're going to leave or move or something. It's because so I made this, instead of having the activity be indoors, you know, setting a table or playing with tools, I tried to make it non-sexist, and I made this thing in the garden where you can put all of these different rakes and stuff and on this pegboard over here or play around with them out there. You'd be amazed. I had Alzheimer's patients skip lunch to play with this thing. I had a guy that was an engineer who hadn't talked in 6 months start trying to tell me what kinds of things you should use in a tool barn out in the, his wife was crying. She was so excited about it. Another one is this flower arranging thing. We literally, they love to arrange flowers, and flowers are very simple. So you put these flowers in here and you can interact. They'll spend 15 minutes playing with that. We had a Sears catalog that, it's nice because we had Sears catalog stuff from kind of, you know, the 30s, kind of your youth, you know, kind of from the 50s, kind of your salad years, kind of from the 60s, kind of, you know, when you're getting older, and then stuff from the 90s, kind of today-ish, you know. And they would go through and they put little yellow stickies on them so they could find these yellow stickies later to see what whoever put that yellow sticky on meant. And it creates a lot of conversation because they have some recollection, some memories of these things that they've seen before. So these are a lot of... Here's one last one I'll tell you about, which is we made this kaleidoscope. I've always... For years I've been making this stupid kaleidoscope. The idea is to have something where you become... An art critic becomes an artist. So it's making kaleidoscopic patterns. And anything you do to the keyboard, it changes what it's doing. If you like them, it keeps making more and more embellished versions of the style that it seems to think you like. And again, people will just play with this thing, and they feel like they're making something. It's making the stuff, but you're criticizing it. And so who becomes the, you know, changing the art critic into being the creative is kind of an exciting transformation that I think is really plausible given the intelligent technology of today. And here's an example where it's a kind of neat, disruptive technology for disabled people. And I'm going on and on about this one because I would love for somebody to take on that website and do experiments in special day centers where we went and documented how the performance gone. I did well enough. I did several versions. I got this thing out the door. There wasn't enough money, blah, blah, blah. And it's on the website. It's been there for a couple of years. But it'd be fun to document it and write a paper about it. Anybody that wants to, I'd love to do that. So since the 2000, I got roped in by Charles Vest. He's the president of MIT. And Nicholas Negroponte, who's my boss, told me to work on voting because there was this problem. And so over the years, we've worked on all sorts of different problems in voting. And just quickly, the deal with voting is registration lost 2 to 4 million votes in 2000. Polling place operations lost 1 million to 2 million, and ballot design lost 1 million to 2 million. Those are the three top ways that votes were lost. Unfortunately, we haven't worked on those so much as we've been concerned about security. And if you want, we can talk about that too. I worked on a new kind of security that's this. But this is a picture from watching people on a full face voting machine in an experiment that I did in New York for reading disabled people. And because the pictures on this page are kind of easier to look at than others, I'll kind of go through some of them on this page. This is something called low error voting interface. And there's an article that came out of mine about aging people voting. But this was not designed only for people with disabilities, but it turns out to be great for them. So what I did is I made what I call the low-error voting interface. Turns out that on a normal voting interface, electronic voting interface is an example of one, people make selections for the person next to where they meant to vote. Kind of one in, like 0.5% to 3% of the time. A lot. So you've been reading about the flipping. The flipping is partially our fault. And that's one problem. Another thing that is that you go down the ballot, you vote for less stuff. It's about 2% per race as you go down. That's why in some places they have laws that the incumbent gets the top race on the ballot, which of course is annoying for us that want the world to be fair. So what I did is I made a ballot where all of the races are shown simultaneously at all times, so people weren't going to miss them. And what's funny is this race is different from the rest because it's the one you're voting on. It's also different because it's green. It's green because I made a selection for Al Gore. Okay, and before I did, I don't have that shown here. I could play with this voting machine later with you. But all of these things matter. The fact that people can see how they selected, we know makes at least 0.5% more people able to vote correctly than not. We know that from a bunch of different sources. We also know that by having all of the races shown simultaneously, and showing which ones you voted for. You can see you voted for this one and this one. This is another version of the low error voting interface. We got half as many errors. Okay. So we're pretty proud of that. And then there's an audio feedback system that I built that I'll talk about a little bit that cut that number by a third again. So just ballot design issues can make a lot of difference. I'll get back to that. I'll just say that I've watched voting in Nevada, New Orleans, Chicago, Brookline, Alston, Arlington, Boston, and L.A. Anyway, lots of places, hundreds of polling places. And it's amazing how much it's hard to see people working hard to make things accessible, and yet there's lots of problems. For example, here, this light. Okay, they're pretty much voting in the dark, but they weren't. Until 9:30 a.m., there was no light there, and no one could vote without a flashlight. Okay, that's a big problem. Why are the people all grouped around this person? Well, you know, you're allowed to have somebody help you vote if you are disabled. This is crap. Okay, this is a way of disenfranchisement. There's a long history of nursing homes coming in with all the same ballot selections and all the same signature on them. We're trying to fight that in various ways. Here's an elderly guy. This is an interesting story. This guy came through. I don't know if I have time for it, though. Let me just move on. Yeah. So this is kind of an accessible place. You see, you put the notice of voting on the front door. Of course, the automatic door hits you in the face if you come up to read it. Okay. Here's an accessible voting place. Where behind these fence, you can see that that's the entrance for the wheelchairs, and they got worried after a few minutes of the bowling place being open, so they opened the door to make sure that people knew how to get in there. Of course, that made that sign go away completely. You couldn't see that sign anymore, and people actually found themselves going in the other side entrance, which was 20 stairs. So there's lots of things that come between our goals of physical accessibility and actually do it. And selection accessibility, I started talking about. What's amazing about these disabilities, I was saying, is 14% of the registered voters have reading disabilities. And for those people, that low-error voting interface that I was just talking about will take them from making, instead of I was talking about 0.5%, 1%, 2-3% for us, it's triple that number. We were getting errors in my New York reading disabilities experiment of, 4 or 5 errors in 12. Okay. This is a problem, and I should have brought it with me, but I've been making a magnifying glass. I shipped to all secretaries of state the 31st of December as a Christmas gift because with people that have dyslexia. Does anybody know any techniques to help go through things for people with dyslexia? Anybody have any experience? Yes? That's amazing. I wonder if that's true. That's interesting. I've never heard that. Really? Do you think that's true?
Yeah.
Have you? Where can I read about that?
I don't know. Reading. It was more like it's like the trick my best friend uses.
I got to read. I got to learn about that.
That's.
Yeah, that's shocking.
They don't have to magnify it at all.
It's I have no idea why that's true. I've got to think about that a while.
It's not always read. It's
media at all. Yeah. This is a documented real system. Wild. So that monochromatic, what is that? Well, anyway, the thing is, if you take a straight edge and you pull it down a page one line at a time, it helps organize things for these people. It's about cognitive disorientation, among other things. So I made this magnifying glass that's long and thin and has a hole in it. I want to put it in the polling booth because the magnifying glasses that they give out today, I've gone into places where they just take the reading glasses off and give them to people. They have scratched up things on the side of the, you know, people go into the polling place that can't read well and are embarrassed to come out and get a magnifying glass. But if it's tied to the polling booth, it's going to help. And if it's a nice magnifying glass that's long and thin, you're going to slide it down. It's going to help you organize yourself, and it's going to help those guys probably cut their errors by you know, 3, 4, or 5 times. And so there's a lot of little tricks like that we're thinking about. How many people that are registered voters have Alzheimer's? We're talking 6.5% to 7.5%. Okay, I mean, you know, and that's a huge number in terms of these guys vote. By the way, that's the scariest part, right? And so this paper I wrote about voting with Alzheimer's, basically, what I say is access, not assessment, because the history of assessment is one of disenfranchisement. And right now we have assistance. And assistance is also disenfranchisement. And so what I want is access. And access is I give you short-term memory help, I give you, you know, physical help, I give you feedback, everything I can do to make sure that if you know what the president is, you can find your way through it. So just to give you
a question.
Yes. That's what a lot of people are always trying to figure out. Well, depending on how it's done, it has what a lot of people like is assistance, because if they can assist, they can send in their assistive helpers, and they can get out the vote for their people, and maybe they can even push it. So that's my point, is that the things you're talking about happen when there's somebody helping. I mean, a funny story that I saw in Brookline was there was a Russian neighborhood, and these people, there was a rash of people voting for both presidents. They'd kind of told each other, you know, they wanted to make sure they voted for the president. So, you know, by the way, overvoting, and overvoting doesn't count. So, like that. But, so I've told you about low error voting interface, and this is an example of an existing voting interface on an existing system, and this is an example of what our system looks like. So you have these three races up there that you can see, and you can't see the rest of the ballot except by pushing next, and here you see all of them. And when you're done. Up here, you see these are all the races that you voted for or didn't vote for. And down here, you can see that these are all the races you voted for and didn't vote for. And all those red ones are you didn't vote. And this shows you which ones you voted for. So you have several different ways of knowing, both by the gray things weren't voted, the red things weren't voted, and clicking on any of those goes back to the ballot. Up there, God bless you if you can figure out what that review screen is doing for you. There's another set of issues about voting that I kind of mentioned, which is everybody's all excited about the new audio voting systems because the disabled people can listen to their voting. Okay, in some of the most common ones that I've seen, it takes 40 minutes to vote a 12 or 15 race ballot. Okay, when you're spending 40 minutes voting a ballot, are you going to make mistakes? It's hard to say, but all I can say is that it ain't the same thing as everyone else is getting. And so we've worked hard on thinking about how to use what's known about cognitive science to design new kinds of audio systems. What if I use different kinds of voices, different kinds of voicing? I use something called earcons. We found out that, you know, if I say, instead of saying beep, I go forward, reverse, next race, I can go 800 words a minute at that point, and I can reduce it a lot. This is a whole area. We've done some research in it. I think there's a lot more space to go. By the way, if we helped make it shorter to be able to project audially what voting selections are, would that help in a lot of the telephone trees that we use to change our cell phone service? Yes. Anybody interested in that? I'd love to work on that. What about 3D? There's this great stuff in cognitive science that you can tell within 15 degrees where some sound's coming from. Why don't we just put all the races in 3D? Right? I'll put the Democrats right in the center. I'll put the Ralph Nader. I don't know where I'll put him. But anyway, but these orienting things can help. We can use audio to orient possibly, and we did a bunch of experiments on that. I could talk a lot more about voting. I've done all sorts of things on voting. Ugh. And by the way, it's all arrows in the back. Everything you do on voting, everyone hates you. So just stay away from it or something. I just want to talk about design for a minute or two. It seems like we're really running out of time. I'm sorry, but... Yeah. So, you know what's kind of interesting about this picture is this was me hiking in the back country near Burma where they were eating rodents. They didn't have any food. They didn't have any money. They slept on boards. They didn't have blankets. But they had stilts. Okay? People play. No matter what. This is the roof in one of those huts. And you can see up here, look at, there's a knife and there's things all there. This is his whole organizing thing. This hut was about this high. And you could reach up and get everything you needed to make your cigarettes or make your food just sitting in the roof. So it's important to try out things and to plan things and to explore. And so I have a tendency to teach classes about design. I taught it. This is the front page from a Camp Invent. It was a 9-year-old workshop for Japanese kids to prototype things. And I said, you know, some things that I taught them is I taught them that things are made from other things by us. I told them about a bunch of mechanical, electrical, and other materials. And then what is inventing? You define the problems, you find things, you realize them, and you modify them when you learn. And here they are working at it. And I'm going to just say my credo for invention is this. Think of designing something as an action movie. Okay, if you think about that action movie, you're swinging through the forest on a vine and it breaks. So you grab for a branch, but there's a snake on it. So you jump over the cliff into the water, but there's a waterfall coming up. And you just keep solving problems at the speed of physics. And that's what it's like to walk. You know, you're always falling, as they say. And I think that what people get wrong a lot of times when they're designing is they think, I'm going to have a great idea and I'll spend all the rest of the time implementing it. No, you don't have a great idea. You have a process of having ideas and solutions, auditioning them, having them compete with each other, because if one of them is really great, that means a bunch of others are bad. How did you decide they were bad right off the bat? And typically what happens in meetings is one guy has an idea and another guy has another idea. And so now, are we talking about the ideas or are we talking about how cute we are? Right? Which person wins might be the person that yells louder. And I really hate attaching the idea to the ego. I like much more the idea of trying out things. And so for me, when I'm designing something, I'm literally usually building two or three. I remember once when I was making a way of of mapping the brain with this HRP peroxidase, and I had to make this digitizing tablet. I made one that was a parallelogram, one that was an arm like this, and then I made one that was electronic. And I was making all three at the same on the bench, same time. And what happens, I'm working on the problems from the other one whenever I've been troubled with this one. And so in a few days, I'd made three digitizing tablets, not one. So I don't think it's slower for me. So you think a lot of ways, possible ways out, and you slowly replace, you know, trying out this idea, you know, doing a skit out of whatever you're planning to do, you know, whatever it is, you know, that you're pretending you can do with whatever it is you're trying to do, and then you start replacing it with real things. Just to give you an example, in that workshop for those kids, the idea was for them, their mom had burnt her hands, and their problem was, how do you take care of yourself? How does she take care of the baby? How does she open the refrigerator? How does he dial the telephone? So they each took one of those problems, and they had to make a prototype, so they really worked. And I remember for about the first 15 minutes, the kids were just sitting there with a facilitator, you know, one of these Japanese professional type people, trying to decide which thing to do. And I went over to one group, and they said, well, what are you guys going to do? And said, well, we're going to work on the baby, and maybe we're going to do this. No, let's work on the baby. Okay, I said, now how are you going to do it? Well, what about a pouch? And I just grabbed a piece of cardboard and put it around me, and took a piece of tape and wound it around so I had a pouch. I stood up on top of the table and I said, like this, I could scoop it up. And they got very excited and they started building things. And as soon as I started acting like I was going to build things, all of the groups, as I went around to them, started playing with their materials and trying, you know, take a coat hanger and make it into a hook so you could grab the refrigerator door and stuff like that. And the point is, the activity, the physical activity is also useful. Drawing, building, physical, you know, moshing things up. All right. And I'm worried about time, but I'll just, let's see, what do I want to say? I'll give you one last one that I'd love to build this year. At Squaw Valley last spring, there was something called No Barriers. Anybody know about that? It's a conference for people with disabilities that want to be athletes. And they do all sorts of show-off things. I climb with a friend of mine named Hugh Hare. Has anyone ever heard of Hugh Hare? What do you know about Hugh Hare? Yeah. So this guy was up in White Mountains when he was 17, and the blizzard was kind of big. 3 days later, they found him in a cave with, well, both legs had to be amputated. So he went back and has put up a lot of routes. He's put up a lot of the first ascents of 514s and the Schwangunks and in Cannon Cliffs. One of the best climbers in the world. And I have the fortune, he's the media lab. I get to climb with him all the time. He mostly doesn't want to climb 514 anymore. But anyway, he helped put on this conference. And what I wanted to do is make a bicycle. And what was different about this bicycle is most of the bicycles for double amputees don't have, what you do is you go like this, right? Now, what's true of your arm muscles? They're small compared to your leg muscles or your back muscles. And so I made this design, and I've got videos of Maya renderings of it, but I'll just show you with this diagram. Imagine instead of our arms, what we do is we have this sliding seat, and we affix our chest in one place. And when this thing goes back and forth, it runs the chain for the wheels. So going forwards, it pulls, and going backwards, it pushes. And basically, I'm able to rock my body back and forth using my big, strong back muscles and my big, strong butt muscles. And if I've got any stumps, I can put them in that socket, and now I can use my thigh muscles to rock me back and forth. And I want to make that bike because you're going to have, you know, four times the muscle mass that you can ride, that you can push with doing that. So there's always places to things that can be designed. And I know you guys are going to build something, and I'd be delighted to think about it with any of you. And I kind of believe that tools are anything that makes us be able to do things we couldn't have done without them. For disabled people, it's a variety of disabilities cause different things to be tools for them. But even for the rest of us, As I was standing here on Mount Everest base camp, feeling awful free, I didn't realize so much that it was these plastic boots and these chromolybdenum spikes that were helping me stand on that, and the carbon fiber shafts of my ice axes were making me able to hold there, and I had the polypropylene keeping me warm, and a 747 had flown me from California, and you know, a lot of different prosthetics we use to do everything we do, and that's what our world is like, is building prosthetics and using them. And I see a lot of people wearing glasses and wearing clothes. We all use prosthetics in one way or another. So thank you.
Okay, if people have to leave, now's a good time, but if you want to stick around and ask questions, we can accommodate that. Yeah.
Yes. What? No, sorry.
I was wondering if you could say, like, what work is being done on that, or what ideas you have as far as how to help voters.
Well, if the ballot shows your, if the ballot, first of all, old people like the big bright colors and the big buttons on their voting machines, and focusing on one race at a time helps. And seeing all of the selections simultaneously helps. I'll give you an example. In 2002, there was an election in California. What was special about this election? It was getting rid of Gray Davis. What else was special about this election? 135 contestants. So how do you choose a contestant? What?
The recall.
135 people running for governor. Now, let me say that there was a Bob Dole running for governor. Do you think that was the Bob Dole that you and I think about? No. There was an Edward Kennedy on that ballot. Is that the same Edward Kennedy that seems to think that Obama's a good idea right now? No. There were a lot of things about that ballot like that. First of all, it had six pages. In L.A., they had the punch cards. They had six pages that these 135 people were spread out over. Does that make the first person more likely? Maybe. So how would you lay out that design so that you'd make it seem that everybody could see that there were 135 selections? I had an idea, no one did it, which was to put them on a circle. And that way, nobody's in front of anybody else. No one's at the top, no one's at the bottom, they're all there. You'd see an awful lot of them at once, right? And if there was some way of taking a ruler and seeing which one you're on now, or comparing this one to that one. There's a lot of things that can be done. I don't know if I'm answering your question. But what we find, for example, is full-face voting. Okay, I used to think full-face voting was a great idea. You have all of the races on the screen at once. Oh, that's so much better. I think it should be just... Look at that. That was for example, I mean, hearing disability. You know, that was 80 decibels, right? That's an amazingly high audio floor for people that have any hearing problems at all. Anyway, what was this? Full screen. Okay, so we did this experiment. What do you think happens on full screen for people with reading disabilities? Now, what's amazing about that is that's what we believed, and we thought that one race at a time would be better, and I believe it is still. But what we found was something very strange. If you walked into our experiment and you had documentation that you were reading disabled, you were better at going through that ballot than able-bodied people. And if you didn't have a documented reading disability, but you were reading disabled, we did tests, you were much worse. Now, why is it that if you had a documented reading disability, you were better than able-bodied people at going through this large screen? Any ideas? It's not just practice. You had prosthetics. You had cognitive prosthetics. You'd gone to classes. You'd learned how to organize yourself. And what happens on these big screens is everyone gets disorganized, not just the dyslexics. And so these dyslexics had a one-up because they'd gone to school the way you guys are going to school. And they knew what to do for the disability. This was an amazing, I don't think anybody's done that. That's another piece of experiment that I'd love to do, is to show where people that are disabled but have done some training might be better at things than people that have no disabilities. And I can give you lots of places to do that. I believe in experiments, if you haven't heard this enough times from me. I believe in objective data. I believe that there's an awful lot to learn. I think that our best ideas are ideas about questions, not necessarily solutions. But still, it's fun making the stuff to test it. And if anybody wants to learn more about that, you know, I'm happy to talk about it. But any more questions?
Thanks once again.
Yeah, it's something I help work on. One laptop or two.